want to welcome everyone joining us online for this virtual policy forum today, discussing the issues of Murthy v. Missouri or Missouri v. Biden, depending when you started following this case. For those of you, if you're watching this, you're probably a little bit aware about this issue, but let me just set the scene for you a little bit. First, I'll introduce myself. My name is David Ancera. I'm a fellow here at the Cato Institute for Free Expression and Technology, and I've been following this case because it involves issues of when the government is communicating with private sector entities, specifically in this case, social media organizations, and when is its communications with those organizations, when are they lawful communications, when are they appropriate, and when do they cross the line to something inappropriate, coercive, or otherwise wrongly putting pressure on those companies. And in doing so, it forces those companies to change their own speech. It infringes on their First Amendment rights to express themselves, and it may impact the First Amendment rights of those social media companies' users as well. And so that was the issue before the court. Just on Monday, they heard oral arguments where the Louisiana Solicitor General represented the states and the individuals who were suing the federal government, and the federal government defended itself before the court as well. So this is an issue which I actually feel very personal about. This is an issue where when the incidents of some of this case were occurring, I was actually at Meta. I was on the content policy team at Meta, writing the community standards for what, you know, the rules of what you can and cannot say on Facebook and Instagram. And so when I see as part of the record here of this case that there were instances where the Nick Clegg, the former deputy prime minister of the United Kingdom and a president at Facebook, saying that, look, he quote, given the bigger fish we have to fry with the administration, this, our current policies, doesn't seem to be a great place for us to be. And we'd be grateful for creative thinking on how we can be more responsive to the White House. I read that and I felt like personally, like, was I doing work to do what was best for Facebook's users? Or was the work of me and my colleagues being used to advance to comply with government pressure? On the other hand, I also know there are plenty of situations where the government has information that we wanted. Communication between the government and our company was very important on issues of security, national security, intelligence, disasters, law enforcement, emergencies. They often had information that we didn't have, and we needed that communication. So I understand also the clear need for there to be communication between government and social media and tech companies. And that's the question of this case. When does it go from acceptable communications between two parties, and when does it become coercive and inappropriate by the government? And so to help us answer these and many other questions, I'm joined by a wonderful panel of legal experts. And so I'll just quickly introduce all of them, and then we'll get into it. First, we have Jess Myers. Jess Myers is the senior counsel at the Chamber of Progress. As a lawyer and a technologist, Jess primarily focuses on the intersection of law and internet. She's widely considered an expert on U.S. intermediary liability law and has written, spoken, and taught extensively on topics such as speech, Section 230, content moderation, intellectual property, and cybercrime. Jess is also currently an advisor to the Trust and Safety Professional Association, and she joined the Chamber of Progress coming from Google, where she was a senior government affairs and public policy analyst. Next, we have Bob Korn Revere, who's the chief counsel at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, where he seeks to defend and sustain the individual rights of all Americans to free speech and free thought. Prior to joining FIRE, he was at the law firm of David Wright Tremaine, where he was a partner for 20 years specializing in freedom of expression and communications law. Bob is a prominent thinker, writer, and advocate on free expression, including one of his most recent books, The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder, The First Amendment and the Censor's Dilemma. And last but not least, we have Kristen Shapiro, who is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, where she provides her expertise on a host of legal matters ranging from education to free expression. Shapiro is also counsel at the law firm of Baker Hostetler, where she provides legal advice and representation on major constitutional issues. Kristen previously served as the Assistant General Counsel in the Office of General Counsel for the U.S. House of Representatives and as an attorney advisor at the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. So with that, before we get started, I just want to quickly remind everyone watching this that you can submit questions via the webpage on Cato. You can also submit questions on Facebook, YouTube, and X using the hashtag Cato1A, and we will have a period of questions and answers after our discussion is over here. And so with all that, I just want to turn it over to our wonderful panel here to discuss the issue that was before the court, jawboning, censorship by proxy, this pressure that's being placed on companies by government. Jess, I know your organization and as well as Cato were together on an amicus brief with the Net Choice organization that filed in support of neither party in this case. Bob, I know FIRE filed as amicus brief on behalf of Missouri, Louisiana, and the individual plaintiffs. And Kristen, I know you've penned a paper at Cato dealing with this issue of how we manage the public policy issue. How do we stop this kind of thing from occurring in the future? So we've all thought and written about this. And so I wanted to start by just asking you all to summarize, just generally sort of speaking, what do you think the most important considerations are here and how you're approaching this issue and this case?
Yeah, I'm happy to take it first since I was mentioned first. Yeah. So thank you so much for having us. It's great to be here. So we, Chamber of Progress, we filed a brief, as you said, with NetChoice, CCIA, and Cato. We took no position on the narrow question, in this case regarding the government's communications with social media companies specifically. Rather, as amici, we participated in support of neither party. To emphasize that whatever decision the court makes, it must have no impact on the First Amendment rights of the social media companies. Our brief also made sense timing-wise, just given the NetChoice and CCIA cases against Moody and Paxton that were just recently heard regarding laws in Texas and Florida, that would also implicate the free speech rights of social media platforms. Our brief makes a few key points. So first off, the court should set clear boundaries limiting the informal actions governments may take to compel private publication decisions. And then when jawboning infringes online speech, liability must remain solely with the government, not the coerced entities. So not the social media companies in this case. Whatever test the court imports, and I know we'll get to this, whether it be coercive conduct from the Bantam Books case that we'll discuss, or significant encouragement, which came from the Blum case that was also discussed, the violative actions are the government's and the government's alone. And where the government successfully coerces a private website to do its bidding, the website itself experiences an injury. So permitting jawboning claims, irrespective of successful government coercion, significant or substantial encouragement, coercion, by contrast, would actually deter governmental intermeddling in private editorial activity just more broadly. So that's sort of the key points that our brief took. And yeah.
Wonderful. Bob, why don't we go to you next?
Sure. Thank you, David. And I guess I should start by saying that in certain ways, this case was personal to me as well. Because when I was still in private practice, I had argued the case of Backpage.com versus Dart, which was one of the earlier cases on the jawboning issue there involving the sheriff of Cook County, putting pressure on credit card companies not to do business with Backpage.com. So again, the idea of government putting pressure on a third party or on an intermediary to get them to do its bidding and to restrict speech. And it's one of the precedents that the Fifth Circuit relied on in reaching the result that it did. Second reason why it was somewhat personal to me is because I did spend some time in my career earlier at the Federal Communications Commission. And this is an agency that is quite familiar with the concept of jawboning. As a matter of fact, there it's referred to as regulation by raised eyebrow. It's a little bit easier in that situation where the agency issues, or more to the point, has the power to revoke broadcast licenses. And so it's a situation where a few choice words from a regulator can have an outside effect on media companies. And so that's really what we faced here. Now, to your point that FIRE and along with the National Coalition Against Censorship and the First Amendment Lawyers Association filed an amicus brief in this case, we did file in support of the respondents. But I don't know if it's quite accurate, or at least maybe not fair to say that we were filing on behalf of Missouri and Louisiana, given the fact that we spent a fair amount of our brief talking about how the attorneys general from those states do quite a bit of job voting themselves, and in fact didn't even pause during this litigation when they were arguing about the First Amendment problems of job voting to stop doing it in other parts of their domain. So one of the points that we wanted to establish in that amicus brief was that job voting needs to be restricted by constitutional rule, and the court should use this case as an opportunity to clarify that rule and also to issue a rule that would affect not just activities by the federal government, but would have broad application across even the activities of state attorneys general. Not so much for a ruling that on the parties in the case that binds them, but a general First Amendment principle that would have application across the board. Now, in that respect, and just picking up on one of the points that Jess made, that the restrictions here or the infractions that by government here were by the government and the government alone and not the the social media platforms. That was one of the points that we wanted to clear up in our amicus brief as well, in that as presented to the lower courts, the issue was really quite clear that this was an example of where government had crossed the line, both in coercing private platforms and affecting their moderation policies, but also in the excessive entanglement, in it, the excessive encouragement and cooperation between government and private parties. But when presented to the court, the question presented was, when do social media companies become state actors? When they engage in this activity, which was not part of the litigation below. And so we encouraged the court not to decide on that sort of joint action theory, but instead to look at precedents like Bantam Books and Blum versus Uretsky for the significant encouragement angle, and to hold that these are examples of where the government has gone too far, urge the court to decide the case not as framed by the Solicitor General, but as it was presented to the courts below.
Great, thanks. And yeah, Kristen, why don't you pick us off with some of the writings you've done for Cato?
Yeah, absolutely. David, thank you for having me. I think as you mentioned in your introduction, my experience in this comes more from the policy field rather than, you know, having, you know, deep experience litigating these First Amendment issues. So my perspective here is pretty pragmatic, really. And that leads to two concerns. The first is an overall concern with the prevalence of jawboning or censorship by proxy or informal censorship at all levels of government, whatever you want to term it. And, you know, as Bob mentioned, it doesn't take much for the government to, when a government official goes to a third party and puts in an ask or a request or some sort of statement suggesting that they need to essentially deplatform a different person, a raised eyebrow, because the incentives of this, not just the social media companies, it could also be credit card companies, banks, et cetera. The incentives there, they're heavily regulated industries and they want to get along with the government. And by contrast, the person whose speech was suppressed may not ever even know about it. It may be pretty minor. They, you know, may be some random person in the middle of nowhere. They're not going to have the same amount of power as a government official. And so the incentive for most social media companies is to kind of go along to get along with the government. So as Bob mentioned, a raised eyebrow might be all it takes. And then the second concern, though, is that, you know, we'll talk a lot about whether the First Amendment is enough to address this, but I would say from a pragmatic perspective, I have deep concerns that First Amendment litigation is going to get us where we need to go. We saw this a lot in the argument, and we'll get into it, about, you know, what the correct First Amendment test is, you know, what is, you know, sufficiently coercive or, you know, significant, encouragement as opposed to just mere encouragement, and whether that test is correct. I'm sure that you probably, David, from your experience as well, the mine run of government requests and asks to social media agencies probably don't amount to, you know, what would be coercive or significant encouragement. It might be, you know, Bob's raised eyebrow might not, is probably not coercive. If it is, that presents its own challenges. I certainly don't think the Supreme Court isn't prepared in any time soon to say a raised eyebrow from a federal regulator is sufficient to amount to coercion. The argument also, we saw other practical problems with First Amendment litigation beyond simply what the test is. The plaintiffs here, and I know we'll get into it, there are serious questions about whether they have standing to seek the relief that they're asking. But then even beyond what was kind of put at issue in the oral argument, there's the fact that most plaintiffs or most individuals whose speech was suppressed will never even know it. Because these are backdoor communications between the federal government and third parties like Facebook service providers. And, you know, an individual speech was suppressed, for the most part, doesn't even know. What's actually stunning about the Murthy case is how much we learned about the extent of the government's communications, because normally that is just something that is done behind closed doors. And to say the least, if you don't know that the government caused your speech to be suppressed, you're not going to be able to sue about it. You don't even know that you should be looking into it to sue. Putting that aside, there's also serious litigation costs to undertake these lawsuits, as well as a major time delay between the time that you file the suit and when you get a judgment in your favor. That just lead to the First Amendment alone. It seems unlikely to me that First Amendment litigation alone, while it's an important component of the puzzle, it's not going to present a complete solution.
Yeah. And we've had it mentioned here multiple times, some of the precedents and the standards that we should consider and the court is considering in this case. And so wanted to jump to a discussion of that standard setting, what the standard should be and the precedents that the court is using. We mentioned Bantam Books as one of the big precedents here there that dealt with the sort of coercion standard. There was the Blum versus Uretsky ruling, which dealt more with the significant encouragement test. And then the Louisiana Solicitor General, who argued on behalf of the states and the individuals, largely appealed to a case known as Norwood versus Harrison. Can you all unpack how well you think these existing precedents apply here? How do the different sides try to apply these precedents? Are they asking the court to make a new standard, or are they trying to appeal to existing standards?
Well, I think the states were trying to draw on existing standards, but they were drawing from different areas of law. So Norwood versus Harrison involved whether or not the government could fund schools that discriminated. And the basic rule from that is that the government can't do indirectly what it's prohibited from doing directly. So if the government can't run segregated schools, it can't fund private parties that do the same thing. Blum versus Uretsky involved Medicaid reimbursements, and that had to do with where there's substantial encouragement to do something that violates the law. But the one that's really on point in the First Amendment context is Bantam Books versus Sullivan, which involved the efforts by Rhode Island to suppress essentially dirty books. But it well illustrates why jawboning is a problem, and particularly a problem in the First Amendment context, because essentially jawboning is just ways in which governments try to evade the rule of law. And the paradox is that the more First Amendment law has become clear, and the more it has set firm standards in restricting government encroachments, the more it has encouraged governments to try and bypass that. And Bantam Books is an example of that itself, where for the preceding 15 years or so, the Supreme Court had established very clear First Amendment standards. It had decided Winters versus New York in 1948, saying that you can't pass a law that restricts access to literature, even if you consider it to be lowbrow literature. 1957, in Butler versus Michigan, the court had made clear that the government can't reduce the adult population to reading only what is fit for a child. And so within a matter of years, Rhode Island came up with a scheme whereby they would have a youth commission that would send lists of titles to bookstores of books they think they thought just wouldn't be so good for young people to read, that they would affect their morals. And those lists, even though the commission itself had no enforcement authority, there was no criminal law involved, the state would send around police officers to local bookstores and say, so you're still selling books on that list? And that was enough to get the bookstores to stop selling those books. And that's where the standard, at least for coercive behavior, comes from. But it, again, illustrates how government simply will try and bypass the rule of law where you have clear standards. And that was what laid the groundwork for what was going on here, because the Supreme Court in recent years has been very clear about saying that you have full First Amendment protection in the online world. And the more it's clear that the government could not achieve what it wanted to achieve directly, it couldn't pass a law or regulation directly affecting moderation standards, then ways are devised to bypass those direct restrictions on formal regulations.
Yeah, I'll just add, huge plus one to everything that Bob said. And as we noted before in our brief, we didn't really advocate for one test or another. We did, however, talk a lot about there needs to be some level of compulsion. And I think it's sort of hard to find in this case. I mean, one of the quotes that I picked out from the Solicitor General was, the First Amendment is not a civility code. And that was in response to the discussion that, the emails that came to Facebook from the government were very severe. They were very intense in language and tone. But I think it's important to note, just because it's intense or because it uses sort of expletives, I think the court sort of understood there isn't really that sort of compulsion factor there. So to that regard, at least with our brief and sort of the position we took, it was very much we need to look at the substance of the messages, the authority of the person who's sending the messages, and also consider as well, I thought Kristen brought up and Bob brought up really good points about, the differences between we're talking about FCC and broadcasting, and when we're talking about the internet, which, by the way, is why the NetChoice and CCIA cases that were just heard are so important, because they are going to establish, does the First Amendment in its full extent actually apply to social media companies? And if it does, we don't really have that sort of licensing structure that, that carrot stick model that we have with the broadcast context. I think the closest we have, and the court discussed this, was Section 230. And even there, there's questions about certain staffers can't just repeal Section 230. It has to be, by the lawmakers, by Congress. But then there's also other questions as to, is that even compulsive or coercive in that regard? These companies operate without Section 230 in all sorts of other countries and markets. So, there's sort of that compulsive, again, whatever standard the court picks, and if they go to Blum, it's sort of the same thing. Blum shouldn't be read as a reduced standard for to Bantam, but more of a complement of is it actually compulsive conduct?
I completely agree with everything they just said. I will just two points. The first is, I agree with Bob's sort of analysis of the key three cases, that they do kind of arise from different areas that could arguably be conceptually distinct, and Bantam's the only one that really is specific to the First Amendment context. It is unclear in my mind, I think it's perhaps unclear in the Supreme Court's mind, exactly how they relate, whether, Bantam and Blum are subsets of Norwood, or, are they reconceived? It would be nice to see a decision coming out that provides some clarity going forward for this. I'm not entirely sure we're going to get that, and the court wants to go that far, but it currently still is unclear in my mind. And then I will say, we have clearly Bantam, it's well established, the government cannot coerce a third party to, deplatform someone. That is, I think of all the things that are clear coming from the argument and coming from the case law, that's well established. But that still leaves significant questions to be answered. Exactly what is coercion? What rises to the level of coercion? And I think a lot of the oral argument yesterday was debating that question beyond just what should the exact test be. For example, the Fifth Circuit and respondents argued that the FBI, I take it because their communications were described by the Fifth Circuit as being, you know, they didn't use curse words or, you know, respond to me ASAP. They just sent very nice requests. So, you know, under your normal level of thinking, you wouldn't think that that kind of amounts to coercion. But the respondents in the Fifth Circuit argued that, well, but it's coming from the FBI. You know, you have to take that into account. The FBI has authority over these entities. They can issue, you know, criminal investigations, and they do have some statutory authority to take down or request to take down posts. And so the very fact that it's coming from the FBI and it's a request is coercive. And I have, you know, sympathy for that. If an FBI agent showed up at my door and asked me to do something, even if they asked it very nicely, I would probably just feel like I needed to do it. At the same time, if you accept that premise, then under respondents' view, basically everything the FBI, all of its interactions with social media companies is judged by the standard of strict scrutiny, because it is by definition, if you know, a social media company complies with the FBI request to take something down, that's, you know, state action, that is take, you know, the government taking down speech in violation of the First Amendment. And you can only do that if it satisfies strict scrutiny. And I, you know, I think there are deep concerns and with the court and, you know, in the government that we do not want every single FBI communication with social media companies being judged by the standard of strict scrutiny. Now, you know, respondents' counsel said, hey, I'm a First Amendment purist. I'm okay with that. But I think a part, you know, and there is a subset, and then there, I think that's a valid, not, you know, position. But I think most people are concerned with the idea that every single communication between the FBI and, you know, a third party needs to be judged by the level of strict scrutiny, because that would really inhibit, you know, potentially even beneficial communication, like you mentioned, between the FBI and social media companies.
Yeah. And just to go ahead. Yes.
If I could just add to that, I don't think it's really a question of choosing one standard or the other, because there's a lot of stuff going on here and you have a massive record, which is, was really quite revealing. And so it's not just asking a question whether Bantam Books applies or whether Blum versus Uresky applies, because you have some behavior that is coercive and you have some behavior that is overly cooperative. And even Justice Kavanaugh, who probably said the most about saying it's a normal thing for members of an administration or in a government to berate the media. And he said, and perhaps based on some experiences that he's had, that it's probably not the first time that profanity or intemperate language has been used in exchanges between White House or agency communication staff and the media. So there is that going on. And then what the court wanted to do is identify when those communications crossed the line. And that was the difficult part, one of the difficult questions that was being discussed. But the other one was excessive cooperation. And even Justice Kavanaugh said, you know, on this partnership point of the government being the partner with social media companies, that does strike me as unusual. And so that's the aspect of this record that differs from other jawboning cases where you simply have government trying to put pressure. Here you have this constant, overwhelming, day after day communications going on, established networks, established meetings for communicating what the administration wants to social media companies. And that does differ. And it is a more difficult test to articulate. And at one point, and I have to say, I will give the Brian Fletcher, who argued for the government, credit for this. Justice Kavanaugh asked, so what if in one of these cooperative discussions, the government tacks onto this, and we're going to pursue antitrust action against you if you don't do what we want? And the response came back, well, that would be a big problem. And some of the communications that came up in this record really go up to that line, if not crossing it. So that is a significant issue here. And I'm hoping the court will address both if it gets past the standing question.
Yeah, I remember the portion where you talk about there about how the Solicitor General there does sort of admit that there could be issues if there's you know, if there was explicitly saying we're going to hit you with antitrust. But there are some elements the record talk about we're gonna have to consider our options, you know, which is like, okay, well, what should we do with that?
Well, that's the old line. You've got a nice business here. It would be a shame.
Yeah. But to your point, and as other folks have brought up, that's not every communication. There are communications where the FBI is seemingly legitimately just sending stuff. There is just communications going on. And so that mixed record, it's a big record, but that mixed record is I think what presents a challenging issue in this case. And I also just want to take a brief moment just for folks who might not be fully aware. I know we've mentioned some other Supreme Court cases that are currently pending and Section 230. I want to give a quick opportunity just maybe for Jess especially to jump into that. Like, what is Section 230? What are these other cases that might be that are in the background, so to speak, that you could sort of maybe see the justices are discussing and thinking about also in this case?
Yeah, thanks, David. I'll always take an opportunity to talk about Section 230. So let's start there, and then we'll go to the NetChoice and CCIA cases. So Section 230 is a law that essentially says websites and users are not liable for third-party content. The way this usually comes up, you know, if I say something defamatory, God forbid, about Bob on Twitter, Bob can come after me. That would be terrifying. Bob could come after me for the defamatory tweet, but notably, he cannot go after Twitter because Twitter didn't author that tweet. And so it's been sort of known as the law that created the internet. Essentially, it's an immunity for these social media companies and us users to be able to actually host user created content. And in the context of the Murthy case, it came up a lot because lawmakers at the time, policymakers at the time, government officials, they would literally tweet, they would say in passing, maybe even put in the emails, you know, maybe we'll have to repeal or revoke Section 230 if you don't make the content decisions that, you know, we're asking you to make. And we heard it a lot kind of directly, but also indirectly, where the, you know, the Biden administration, the Trump administration would both talk openly about repealing Section 230. And I guess the administrations kind of see it as this sort of as a quote gift to the social media companies. I think what's important to sort of keep in mind is that Section 230 doesn't really grant any new rights. All it is a procedural fast lane for the First Amendment. Remember, the First Amendment is what grants these private companies their ability to do content moderation and act as online publishers and have editorial discretion. That dovetails nicely with the NetChoice and CCIA cases that we've sort of brought up before. And this is in regards to laws in Texas and Florida that would essentially, and kind of ironically, given the Murthy case, essentially tell these services what they can and can't carry when it comes to content. Now, those cases have nothing to do with Section 230. Those are pure First Amendment cases. But as you can imagine, Section 230 kind of gets implicated and just given, the way that it procedurally operates. But those cases, the heart of the question really is, do online services have First Amendment rights? And for those of you who are listening to this and are feeling some deja vu, yes, the Supreme Court already did address this back in the late 90s in Reno v. ACLU and had said undoubtedly that, yes, the First Amendment is crucial. It's for online companies, for online expression to flourish and thrive. What I found, connecting this back to the Murthy case, what I found to be, I would say, maybe encouraging, a few of the justices, I think Justice Kagan specifically, actually referred back to social media companies like Facebook as, quote, speech compilers, sort of recognizing that these social media platforms, they operate in this duty as online publishers. And as online publishers, they too make editorial decisions. They are compilers of all of the speech that all of us put up online. And Kagan also talked about how Facebook's content moderation policies and the enforcement decisions that they make are Facebook's own viewpoints, which is a core part of the NetChoice and CCIA cases as well. It's all about whether when these services do content moderation, are they expressing a viewpoint of their own, or are they just doing just taking content down? And depending on who you ask, you know, I think the correct answer there is that indeed it's just like with the New York Times when they decide what to put on the front page or articles they decide to run or not run. It does express viewpoints that these services, that when they make decisions about what content they want to carry and what content they don't want to carry, it expresses a viewpoint of what the service sort of endorses. You can compare it, you know, compare what's allowed on Facebook today versus what's allowed on Elon Musk's X, for example. So that's sort of how all of these connect, but just kind of getting back to the point here, I thought that the oral arguments, again, were encouraging with regards to the net choice cases. And I think there's sort of this deep understanding for many of the justices that essentially these services operate like online publishers and very akin to their traditional offline counterparts. They have First Amendment rights to do editorial discretion, to make editorial decisions.
I think that background is very helpful. And if I could just add, people can be forgiven if they're a little bit confused about what's going on in these cases, because the Supreme Court is facing 5 social media cases this term alone. And you have people sort of all over the board. 2 were decided last Friday, and we could do a whole other panel on those. But there are also the net choice cases that involve direct regulation of states attempting to regulate the moderation decisions of social media companies. And the irony here is that the states that are in the Murthy case arguing that this nudging by the Biden administration is the worst First Amendment violation in history are also supporting the states that want to regulate moderation decisions directly. These are absolutely irreconcilable, as we pointed out in our amicus brief, that the attorneys general who are advocating a First Amendment position in the Murthy case not only themselves violate the principles that they are trying to espouse here, but then are advocating in the same term, in the same court, a directly opposite theory of the First Amendment when it comes to direct regulation of speech. So I can forgive your listeners if some are confused about these positions, and it's because of the politics. And my personal view is that pretty much politics either diminishes or destroys most things that it touches. And that's one of the things that has made this issue divisive, in that this has been billed as a case against the Biden administration to stop the evil Biden administration from meddling with social media. In fact, this cuts across all administrations. The Trump administration was famous for bullying the media. It was famous for going after social media platforms and threatening to repeal Section 230. The record in this case established that this is something that started during the Trump administration and was carried on in the Biden administration as well. And the question is, when does the First Amendment impose a limit on that kind of interaction, and sometimes very threatening interaction, between government actors and private media companies?
If I can tack on just one more quick point to that note, there's also sort of, we talked about the hypocrisy of these states, but you also are seeing in these red states, at the same time, they are clamoring for government engagement in kids' online safety. They talk all the time about how social media is terrible for kids, it's horrible for their mental health, and we need the government to step in. And then we're seeing in this case, again, they're arguing for, okay, no government interaction. And I thought Justice Jackson really, she really nailed it when she said, well, it seems like the breadth of this injunction, and those of us on this panel may agree or disagree, but it seems like the breadth of this injunction would actually reach governments just warning the general public, saying in one of their more general statements, hey, kids are eating Tide Pods because of a Tide Pod challenge, maybe that's not so great. And so, again, there's sort of this like dissonance between what's being argued by these same states here in these cases, in the Murthy case, and then what they're actually going off and saying and sort of begging the government to get involved. It goes directly to Bob's point that this isn't really about content moderation or about protecting kids. It's politics. It's all politics.
I have just 2 points to add. The first is, I think Jess made a strong analogy between the social media platforms being sort of the modern day publishers and, making their own decisions, having their own First Amendment rights. And I think in many respects, that is what's so unsettling about what the communications we see in some of these cases, because you would never imagine, or at least you would hopefully never imagine, a federal official going to the Wall Street Journal and saying, you may want to not publish this author or something. I mean, certainly you can imagine them correcting a misstatement or something, But just, you know, the idea that the White House would have day-to-day meetings with the Wall Street Journal about what it publishes or the New York Times is outlandish. And then second is, I'll just throw in a pitch as well. You know, we're mentioning other cases. The NRA v. Volo case was also argued at the same day as Murthy. And it doesn't involve social media, but it does involve, I guess, jawboning or censorship by proxy. And, you know, briefly for the audience, a New York financial regulator basically decided after the Parkland shootings that she was going to go after the NRA and target the NRA by encouraging insurance companies to not do business with the NRA. I mean, that's a very high level summary of the case.
Nice way to put it.
But that's essentially a pressure campaign for insurance companies to not do business with the NRA. There's some more nuance there, but it's not worth going into. And what's interesting, I think, beyond, you know, just those very concerning facts, is that the Solicitor General, while defending the Murthy case, weighed in favor of the NRA, who, by the way, was represented by the ACLU before the Supreme Court, David Cole. And so I think it is unlike, I think, David, you mentioned this case was very, the Murthy case is very sweeping. It's very complicated. It involves, you know, many different officials with many different types of authority, many different communications over a period of time on different topics. Whereas this, the NRA v. Volo case is very targeted. It's a much cleaner record. It's actually up on a motion to dismiss. And so I think it is easier for the court to conceptualize the First Amendment issue here as just being much more concrete than what was presented in the Murthy case. And so while I think what's possible is that we're going to see some sort of narrow holding potentially on standing in the Murthy case. Whereas, hopefully the NRA v. Volo case gives the court an opportunity to wax poetic about the First Amendment and, you know, explain exactly why censorship by proxy poses a bunch of different First Amendment problems.
Yeah, and I appreciate your comment about how the justices definitely felt a little discomfort with some of the ideas around, like, is the kind of behavior that we see in this case, is that something that occurs that we would think is acceptable with you know, standard media companies? I think it was Justice Alito cracked a joke about how if the media writes something that the justices don't like, that the Supreme Court media people should go curse them out and claim that they want to be partners and review everything that media organization puts out. So there definitely seems to be, like I said, there's something makes this uneasy about some of this, but that's, like I said, that's some of the fact pattern, and there are many different cases with different fact patterns, which makes these somewhat difficult to, there's similarities, but also clearly significant differences. Jess, you also mentioned, and this is a good segue into the injunction, because as I mentioned in my introduction, there is information that social media companies want from the government. And I think this is another piece of that fact pattern. There are cases where the social media companies are going to the government to ask explicitly for help on something. They're trying to seek, you know, appeal to their government for help on some issue. And like, that seems to be something that, like, the government has information, the social media companies want. Of course, we don't want to stop that. And the question that has been raised is, well, does the injunction do some of that, or the injunction that had been in place under the Fifth Circuit and the lower court's rulings? And so at the same time, we see some communications which seem more coercive that do get toward that line of like, we're going to have to consider our options if you don't do what we want. And you see, like I said, as I also mentioned, Nick Clegg seemingly acknowledging that pressure is working. We're going to move the line because we want to be in good standing with the administration. So all these mixed standards. And so the question I guess I have for all of you is, how do we seek remedy here? Is the injunction that was put forward by the Fifth Circuit and the lower courts, is that an appropriate measure? What do we do in this sort of situation in terms of remedy?
Yeah, I will say, David, you and I, we shared similar experiences. Before I was on Google's government affairs team, I actually was in their trust and safety team, so I saw this firsthand as well. This is somewhat of a funny / silly example, but there's what's actually written in the injunction and then the actual effect of the injunction, even if it doesn't say, you know, certain types of discussions at the government says to the public. It may not specifically say that that implicates job owning in this situation, but the sort of, I guess you can call it a chilling effect here, still stands. But when that injunction actually came down, I actually had a dinner sort of scheduled with my friends in DOJ. And immediately, right after that came out, they texted and said, "Look, we're not gonna meet with you." And I at the time, I wasn't even working for the tech companies; I was working for Chamber of Progress. But said, "Look, we can't even meet with you. We don't want to be seen with folks who are representative of tech." And I think that was it. Really, sort of exemplified the concerns that the government actors specifically had at the time and might have with future communications. I do recall when I was in trust and safety that. Especially I was in trust safety at the time of the COVID pandemic. So we were getting information from all sorts of different sources. And as much of experts as we all are in trust and safety, we're not also health and human services experts, for example. And so there are instances where it's really helpful to have that sort of back and forth with government that may have more information when it comes to being able to assess our own editorial decisions and policies. In my opinion, I don't think the injunction was, the necessary, the right remedy here in this case. With regards to, what is the right remedy, I do want to call out, I thought it was interesting that the specific emails at issue, why were they laden with expletives? Why were they yelling at Facebook? It's because Facebook wasn't doing what the government was asking them to do. And so I think there's a lot of, before we rush to what should the solution be, keeping these companies fully protected by the First Amendment, for example, so that they can continue to push back on decisions that they don't wish to make when they're requested by the government. I think that's really important. The Section 230 immunity being in full tact. I know that's kind of a legacy debate at this point, but keeping that in full tact is, again, what pushes these companies to be able to make their own, to feel empowered to make their own decisions, regardless of what's happening in the political realm. But then again, I also have to question, is it really an issue here? Because a lot of what we saw is these social media companies really pushing back on the requests that were being brought forth by the government.
David, I will add on the injunction. I think it shows the difficulty in crafting kind of injunctive and judicial remedies. And it highlights a lot of the issues with kind of the doctrinal highlights and issues that we've talked about. So the district court entered a very broad injunction against, guests, urging, encouraging, inducing third parties to take down speech. But it also had very broad exceptions that I don't think have been talked about as much. There was an exception for permissible government speech on views on government concern, as well as, foreign influence campaigns with respect to elections. And so arguably some of those exceptions are broad enough to sweep in some of the complaints that plaintiffs had in the case. For example, the Hunter Biden laptop story was argued to be a foreign influence campaign at the time that those, the companies were censoring those posts. So I think both in terms of the breadth of the underlying prohibition, as well as the exceptions, the district court injunction was just not very useful. And then the Fifth Circuit narrowed it, I think appropriately, to coerce or significantly encourage the social media companies to take down speech. I think that was appropriate because, what is inducing? Is it mere persuasion? Like if I, give a speech that says, I think that, Facebook should be taking down this without any sort of coercion, that doesn't cross the line currently, an existing doctrine for what violates the First Amendment. At the same time, saying that government officials can't coerce or significantly encourage social media platforms to take down speech is essentially like telling them government officials need to comply with the First Amendment. Because there's so much debate about, well, what is coercion? What is significant encouragement? And I think the Solicitor General had a point at oral argument that really read home to me was that the problem wasn't so much with the term coercion or significant encouragement as narrowed by the Fifth Circuit that they used in the injunction. The problem is sometimes with the preceding analysis of the Fifth Circuit gave about what constitutes coercion being so broad that it made the Fifth Circuit's use of those terms themselves very vague and unclear. So for example, you know, when the Fifth Circuit said it's coercive if an FBI agent, even if they politely just ask or request something, that is inherently coercive. You know, the injunction read together with what the court said in the opinion suggests that the FBI can't make mere requests of social media companies, no matter how polite or non-threatening, because it's inherently coercive. And so again, this just shows how difficult it is to craft really well-defined remedies.
Yeah, well, Kristen, I'm glad you drew a distinction between the district court's injunction and the one issued by the Fifth Circuit, because they really were markedly different. The district court injunction was pretty much boundless, and as you say, had those exceptions that were really impossible to decipher. And I think, if anything, the district court injunction in its scope contributed to the sense in which this was viewed as a political case. I thought the Fifth Circuit quite appropriately narrowed the injunction, made it fewer people subject to it, including people who were not members of the government, and also then narrowed its terms. I have to say I have some warm feelings about it, because it patterned the injunction based on the one that we got in the Seventh Circuit in Backpage versus Dart. But I don't think it's an impossible injunction to follow, and particularly if the decision itself is clearer about the kinds of things that do cross the line. And that's where the court, both in terms of its reasoning, how it gets to that point, and then the relief that it orders, can help bring some meaning and some narrowness to these concepts. But I have to say, too, it was particularly amusing in some ways to see the government's reaction to this, saying, oh, there's a chilling effect, which I, you know, as a First Amendment advocate, I'm quite familiar with the concept of the chilling effect, but it's not all that often you see the government all that concerned with chilling effects. And so for government actors to say that they were going to be too chilled in their speech just struck me as kind of funny. But in this case, and in the context of this being presented to the Supreme Court, I think that to a certain extent, the unwillingness of federal agencies to meet with people like Jess was tactical, that it was a decision made to try and bolster the government's argument that it would not be able to have any communications if this injunction remained in place. And that was clearly not what the injunction ordered.
Yeah. And so to that point, getting more into, I think we spend a little bit of time focusing on trying to read some tea leaves, what we saw actually before the court, what we saw in oral arguments specifically. There's a few notable cases. We've talked about some already, Justice Alito joking about media people cursing out other media organizations. But one that really stuck out to me, and I said, feel free to bring up other examples that you thought were striking, was Justice Jackson's sort of train of thought, generally speaking, on establishing that coercion is sometimes okay by the government. And both sides were like, yes, strict scrutiny, very specific circumstances, but she just kept bringing it back, ultimately ending with a statement toward the end of the oral arguments where she said something to the effect of the First Amendment is hamstringing the federal government doing what it wanted. And to your point, Bob, I sort of felt like that's sort of the point of the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. In general, that was one thing that stood out to me, but I was hoping in other sort of notable pieces of argument, try to read the way the court is going. I can tell where Justice Jackson is going with her line of arguments. But generally speaking, where do you guys think the case is headed, and where do you think, what would you think of some of the specific arguments that were made by the different justices?
Well, if I could speak first to the comments that you just mentioned from Justice Jackson, I found those very disturbing, where she was simply saying, well, you just can't hamstring the government, which, as you say, that is kind of the point of the First Amendment. But the other aspect of it was I found it very difficult to follow her argument that said, if you have a compelling interest and you meet strict scrutiny, then you can take down speech off the internet. Now, Yeah, if you go through a judicial process, you can. But what we're talking about here is bypassing the law altogether. And to simply say you have a compelling interest, well, the government always says it has a compelling interest in taking down one kind of speech or another. That doesn't get you where you need to go. And so the question is, what kind of extra legal process can the government use to modify what platforms are going to have before it bumps up against the First Amendment? Now, in terms of overall predictions, I tend to avoid making predictions about where the court's going to go. And here, it's not really an exception. Right after the argument, I had a couple of other webinars like this where people were quite willing to make predictions. I'm not. And even after going back through the transcript and reading the transcript with some care, I'm not quite ready to make a pronouncement. I can see certain leanings. I can see how it might be attractive to decide this on standing grounds, although there that raises some separate problems about when you would have an appropriate case, what would be required to be in the record before you could actually show that you have both traceability to the government's actions and redressability through some sort of judicial solution. But I think you can sort of divide up based on the kinds of questions that were being asked, where you think the tendencies were among the justices. I think it's clear that Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson are not going to be in favor of upholding the Fifth Circuit in this case. Justices Alito, Thomas, and probably Gorsuch appeared to be leaning in that direction. And then you have in the middle Justices Kavanaugh, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Barrett. And you know, a close reading of the kinds of questions they were asking. And again, you don't make predictions necessarily based on what questions were asked, because questions can be asked for a wide variety of purposes. But I think if you're reading the middle justices for the kinds of questions they were asking, they may be leaning toward reversal, but it's hard to say. I think it could go either way.
Yeah, I don't have much to add on top of what Bob's great analysis. I will say that, my impression after, looking at the argument transcript was that the court didn't seem inclined to adopt some broader test beyond simply saying the government can't, coerce or have significant encouragement of, these parties to take down speech. It did not seem inclined to have, saying that, by the idea that mere persuasion, it would be sufficient to trigger the First Amendment as well. And I also don't think it seemed inclined to say that, well, just because you are a government official, in the White House with the FBI, the fact that you're making into question that status is inherently coercive. And so given those kind of limits of, my prediction as to kind of what if they address the merits, what they would say, I think the concern I have coming out of the argument is that we're really not going to get an opinion that addresses or have a doctrine that it, makes us all so uncomfortable with what the mind run of what the government is doing, this partnership to censor speech with social media, requests that are, framed politely, but really, as a practical matter, that social media has every incentive to comply with them. And so I just don't, that's why I kind of, at the start of my remarks, I said, I'm not convinced that the First Amendment litigation is going to get us there. And I didn't see anything in the argument that changed that view.
Yeah, I'll add. So I my viewpoints are shared with Kristen and Bob as well. Just huge plus one there. What I'll add. So I think what we saw in the arguments with this case was a similar hesitancy that we saw in the Gonzalez case last year, the Gonzalez v. Google case, and even in the NetChoice cases that we saw as well in the past couple of weeks. And I think there's sort of this hesitancy of the court to have any sort of broader decision or ruling on these social media cases because I think that they understand the trade-offs on both sides here, both with regards to, quote unquote, hamstringing the government, with regards to interfering with the social media companies' content moderation decisions as well. I will sort of point out that this one is particularly tricky because if the court is to wade in and say, you know, look, there's joint action or there's some sort of, or to draw even a line on joint action or collaboration here, it then starts to bleed into some of these other social media cases that involve the content moderation decision-making aspects. And then there are questions about, look, is that state action? Is it Facebook's viewpoints? And so each of these types of cases, they, I mean, they each sort of have effects on each other. So I took the questions as more of hesitance and an understanding of the trade-offs and how these services work. I will say I was admittedly a bit, I struggled to follow Justice Jackson's questions as well a little bit with regards to this case, but also in some of the previous cases. And just to put respectfully, that might be just reflective of either, you know, misinterpretation or misunderstanding of the doctrine and maybe even the operations of these social media services. But, you know, I won't make a prediction here, but I think just given that the discussion, there was a lot more discussion around the standing aspects. I think the traceability question is an important one, especially with some of the facts in this case that show even the timelines don't really add up, where, you know, the government sent an email and then months later content was removed. I think that poses some very, again, crucial questions about whose decision really was it. Was it government influence or was it Facebook's own accord, for example? So, you know, I can see this being narrowly decided. I can really see it being decided on just the standing question alone, which I agree with Bob, that that sort of raises some new questions as to then what is the right case here. And I think that that narrow decision is going to derive from, again, this hesitance to really do or say anything on these social media cases because of the consequences it'll have on either side.
Yeah, and just to pick up on that, I think we saw that reflected, as Jess mentioned, in the decision last term in Google versus Gonzalez. I think it showed that the court is really aware that if it got things wrong, that it could have serious consequences. So it tried to decide matters as narrowly as possible. What I think you can take away from this argument is that the Solicitor General of Louisiana gave the court absolutely no help in trying to locate what an appropriate standard would be. And he was asked numerous times, what about this situation? Would that cross the line? Would this be coercive? Would this be too much cooperation? And he continued to take a hardline position, which left the court, if it's going to reach the merits, to come up with a standard of its own. That's not really where you want to leave the court.
And as you've alluded to multiple times, Kristen, and specifically right now, you've talked about how, you know, litigation is one way that we can address this issue. And obviously we're talking about a Supreme Court case, but there are also potential other levers that we can pull here. And I know you've written on this for Cato, so I wanted to talk about if the courts aren't the best avenue, or maybe there's a avenue, but what are the other things that we can do if we're concerned by how this line drawing is difficult, if we're concerned with what the test should be, but we can't really figure out how we balance those equities perfectly. And to your point, a lot of this is behind closed doors, so we'll never know about a lot of these equities anyway. What are some ideas for how we can address the issue of jawboning, of government pressuring people to do things that they maybe don't want to do? How can we deal with that from a public policy, either the executive branch or Congress working together? What are options that we have?
Thank you for the opportunity to plug my white paper, David.
Yeah.
So my colleague, Andrew Grossman, and I published last October a white paper shining a light on censorship with Cato, overviewing other options besides First Amendment litigation to address censorship by proxy. And, you know, as you mentioned, the current legislation mostly revolves around prohibition, the government can't, you know, contact social media companies to do X, Y, and Z, take down posts, deplatform people, et cetera. And, you know, our take was that that runs into pretty much the exact same problems that we've been discussing throughout this last hour with, if you are going to prohibit something, you need to be very careful in how you define it. Because, you know, as you mentioned at the start, David, there is some good government communication with social media companies. Sometimes the requests are beneficial and not don't pose a problem under the First Amendment. And so and no one really has seemed to offer an exact definition of what the government should and should not precisely be able to do in this space. Certainly any workable line that would clearly fall within, you know, what the government can constitutionally prohibit, would be so narrow that it wouldn't reach most of the concerning aspects and communications that we've talked about today. So we put together an alternative approach. It's narrower, but it's just transparency that, okay, don't prohibit it, at least not to start. Just make the government disclose it. So every federal official, you know, if they are, you know, asking a social media company to take down, you know, speech, to deplatform it, to, you know, downgrade the speech, or to, you know, put a tag on it or something, in one way or the other. And by the way, this would apply to non-social media companies too, like credit cards or banks, any service provider really. Then you need to disclose it. And this could be pretty simple. I mean, I worked for the Office of Legal, Department of Justice, and we had routine disclosure forms that we would have to fill out. If you contacted the media, there was a 5-minute form you had to fill out explaining the media contact. If you had any contact with a foreign government, you had to report it. If you traveled abroad, you had to report it. So it could be a very simple form. And the Office of Management and Budget would compile this, redact any sort of, you know, classified or personally identifiable information as appropriate, and then publish it so that we at least have a sense of what the government is doing, and can hold the government appropriately accountable, as well as, notify through the, you know, service provider, say, you know, notify the individual who was targeted. So that way they know as well. And we see several advantages to this, two main ones. The first is we think, you know, just having transparency would go a long way to stopping the nefarious government conduct. Because, you know, transparency isn't completely effective, but it has worked a lot in this space. You know, the Twitter files caused a massive controversy when the, you know, Department of Homeland Security's Disinformation Government Board was leaked. That was immediately scrapped overnight. And so we think transparency and shining a light on what the government is doing could in and of itself get rid of the worst government, most problematic government conduct. And second, even if the transparency alone doesn't solve, you know, all the issues that we have concerns with, it does provide more knowledge about what the government's doing. And so, you know, it can be used by the parties to bring First Amendment cases over it. And by the way, you know, when the part of the reason, I mean, you saw this a lot in the oral argument, the sense from the Supreme Court that, well, the government contacts social media all the time. And you know, we just have this vague sense that there is this wide realm of government communication and not all of it's bad with social media companies. Well, if we had a nice database of exactly what the government's doing, perhaps that could help inform, a First Amendment standard going forward. So we're not, you know, trying to have some, you know, opine on what the standard should be in the dark. We know what the government's doing and can appropriately, you know, craft an injunction or craft, you know, a judicial doctrine to account for really the only problematic aspects of it. And I will, you know, conclude with the point that because you mentioned, you know, legislation or regulation. We do envision this kind of happening via legislation, most likely, because otherwise, you know, what's the executive branch's, you know, interest in doing a regulation? We also imagine that, you know, a statute of limitations on these claims might be like, say, 6 years. So it spans presidential administrations so that, you know, you're not confident that, you know, if you're a political official in the White House now, in the Biden White House, well, you don't know who's going to be president in 4 years. And there's a 6-year statute of limitations. So, you know, you better, you know, there's a reason to comply with the transparency. But, you know, putting that aside, this could also be done via executive action. So if there is, for whatever reason, a good government type president in office, they have the inherent statutory authority to basically implement this via kind of presidential action and executive regulation. So this, you know, doesn't necessarily require legislation. And in general, we think this is just an easier first step, because if you're not prohibiting the communication, you're just saying you need to be transparent about it. You could be over inclusive, because you can, it's fine if if this transparency proposal sweeps in FBI communications to social media companies to take down child sexual abuse material, because there, it's not prohibiting that communication. It's just saying that you need to disclose it.
Yeah. Wonderful. I think we've now have we've reserved a little bit of time for some questions from the audience. Just a reminder to the audience, you can still fill out some questions, and I can we can try to get to them. We do have a good number in the queue already, so we'll try to get to them. So a question we got from one person here is about asking essentially about some of these kind of hypotheticals that were raised, I think alluding to them. And the question is, do the dangers of misinformation provide any compelling reason? We've talked about different scrutiny standards, different levels of compelling interest. Do they provide any compelling reason to allow for a more relaxed interpretation of what constitutes jawboning? So how does the current issues around misinformation address what the standard should be for constitutionally protected speech and jawboning?
Well, who's disinformation? You know, that's always the question. We don't have a ministry of truth, and we don't need a ministry of truth. And generally, one person's disinformation is the other person's on-point message. And so, you know, this is especially what you don't trust government to be the arbiter of. And certainly, I think keeping a strong constitutional standard against jawboning is essential, regardless of the nature of the speech that you're talking about here. I think in that respect, having some sort of transparency mechanism has a lot to recommend it for a variety of reasons, because if you see someone in the government trying to influence which way the debate is going for purposes of disinformation or for some other purpose, there is a record of it. It doesn't depend on the vagaries of the voluntary release of information like the Twitter files or discovery in a given case. It would be there to be perhaps used in litigation if you have a problem arise. But the important point there is that any kind of transparency requirement would have to be an obligation imposed on government and not on the platforms. Because the only way we're going to know when you have this sort of background interference is if the government is obligated to disclose that kind of information.
Right. I'll piggyback. I completely agree with Bob's, you know, what is misinformation, you know, who gets to decide it analysis there. I'll also add that, you know, if the standard is just, well, coercion or significant encouragement kind of under existing doctrine, then no, I don't think even obvious disinformation, you know, stuff that is, you know, provably false. I don't think we need to adjust the standard, but I think if we are going to, if you know, consider relaxing the standard to sweep in prohibiting the government from persuasion, that doesn't rise to the level of coercion, then you do have to think about, well, isn't it helpful for the government to be able to point out, well, X, Y, and Z is just provably wrong?
We discussed a little bit here about standing. Can one of you potentially describe what the standing issue here is? The legal idea that you need standing to challenge these cases. What is going on there? Even helpful for me as a non-lawyer amongst a panel of lawyers, but help our audience as well understand. Several of you mentioned standing issues and how the court definitely spent a little bit of time on it.
Well, I'll jump in. You know, standing is just the idea that, you know, if you're a plaintiff suing in federal court, you can't assert some generalized grievance that's shared by everybody. You need some particular injury to you. And the kind of the elements are, you have to have an injury in fact. It needs to be traceable to the defendant, and it needs to be redressable by the court relief. And I think Jess mentioned earlier, there's serious questions, and I don't know enough about the record to say exactly what's satisfied here, but there were serious questions raised at oral argument about standing. You know, for example, you know, as she mentioned, someone whose post was taken down 2 months after a government meeting, can you say that is really traceable to that government meeting, particularly when, you know, the social media companies also, you know, have an incentive and have their own policies to police, you know, to have their content moderation policies. And so the idea that that is, you know, traceable to a meeting, it's a difficult factual hurdle, and one of the reasons why First Amendment litigation in this space is difficult.
Yeah, and it's particularly difficult in the social media context, because if you look at the case that just followed Murthy, NRA versus Volo, you had definite factual events that the case was about. What was said at a given meeting, guidance letters that were sent, press releases. You could focus on those and then ask whether or not an unconstitutional result occurred because of those specific contacts. But here you're talking about a process over a number of years where you had continuing contacts and continuing demands for changes in moderation policies. And to locate any one decision to, say, deplatform someone or to delete certain information because of a particular contact by someone in the administration is very difficult to do, even though the notion of that kind of close involvement between government and private actors raises serious questions. And so the question becomes, and either for this case or cases to follow, what do you have to show to be able to show that there is an unconstitutional influence by government on the way in which these decisions are made?
Yeah, and I think that social media aspect too greatly affects the redressability question as well, because then the question is, you know, what can the court do to sort of make the injury whole, make the person whole, is bringing the injury? And in the context of social media, when content moderation decisions can span, it's not just, you know, look, the government didn't throw them off of Twitter. Forcing Twitter to put their posts back up brings in its own set of First Amendment concerns. So I think the court was really trying to wrestle with, you know, both the traceability aspect that was discussed here, but also what are they supposed to do to remedy the actions that were brought in front of the court?
Yeah. Another question we got here is, and it parallels some of the things I've read online in some of sort of the legal and policy debate, is we're discussing what the line should be. And like I said, maybe transparency is that we need more transparency to figure out what it should be. But this idea that in some of these cases it's not clear. There's like maybe it could go either way. So this could be jawboning. This could not be jawboning. Maybe this is coercive. Maybe this is significant encouragement. In those cases where the line between coercion and encouragement is difficult for the parties to discern, should there be sort of a, like, tie goes to the average person, tie goes to the jawboned party because of the more, and we've mentioned this a few times, the sort of inherent power that the government has on this issue, the ability to raise an eyebrow and to potentially get what you want. Should we be thinking about potentially giving sort of preference in these close cases to the jawboned party?
Well, Justice Roberts has very famously written that when there's a conflict between the government and the speaker, the tie goes to the speaker. And I think that is a general rule in First Amendment cases. But here, the issue is getting that information in the first place. What were the ingredients involved in determining whether or not jawboning was taking place? And that's, again, where transparency would be very helpful. This case was unique because it had a full record, even with preliminary discovery, where you have a 20,000 document record that you have to sort through to try and determine, you know, where the truth lies. Getting that kind of information is going to be difficult in any case, but it would be made far more easy to do if you have some sort of transparency requirement.
I'll also say, David, that you know, if it doesn't clearly rise to the level of coercion, then it's, you know, kind of just government speech. And maybe you could say maybe the doctrine should reach that or not, but there is value in, you know, government speech, especially to, I mean, the First Amendment. And I think the Solicitor General made a good point that, you know, the federal government doesn't have a First Amendment rights. We're not talking in the realm of Constitution, but, you know, listeners have First Amendment rights and we want information. And so we don't necessarily, I don't know that the tie necessarily goes to the speaker here, especially when it's, you know, suppressing government speech that's not coercive.
Though I will say, and I agree with both points here, I will say we talked about at the end of our brief, if there is any injury here, it is to the private entity that was coerced, persuaded, et cetera. And if that entity, if the private online publishers have an ability to get their injury redressed or can bring those sorts of claims against the government more frequently, perhaps it would even cut down on the sort of persuasive, lesser, even coercive type discussions that we saw in this case.
Yeah, and to speak to the government speech point, I think it's important to distinguish that government speech is not protected by the First Amendment. And again, to the Solicitor General's office's credit, he made clear that the First Amendment isn't the source of the government's ability to speak. It comes from just the structure of government. And that makes clear that government speech is the exercise of government power, is an aspect of government power. It is not a right. And therefore, the tie does go to the speaker because powers do not outweigh rights. And so when you're talking about the exercise of the First Amendment, you can't simply say, well, I'm exerting the government's power through speech, and therefore you overcome that. And that's why it is important to find that line between persuasion and coercion. The government does have the power to persuade. It has a tremendous platform from which to persuade, but it can't use that platform to issue threats or other kinds of entreaties that intrude on First Amendment rights.
I have another question here that asks about, I think, a comment that Justice Alito made. And we mentioned here sort of the record here is pretty vast. And Alito at one point, I think, sort of said, like, we're having this colloquy with our colleagues that's getting off track. And we're sort of wondering, the court did spend, I think, a decent amount of time looking at sort of hypotheticals. And the question, I think, from this person writing is, why didn't we hear more about sort of some of the specifics of the record? We heard some, but some people, like, I think it's Jay Bhattacharya, is involved in this law. Some never came up at all, as far as I can remember, in the discussion. So the question basically, why did we hear so little from the 20,000 page record, if you agree with that statement? I don't know, but yeah, that's the question we have here.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear what my co-panelists think of this as well. This was actually one of the things that I flagged as being part of the hesitancy. This is at least what signaled to me that the court is probably going to look for the most narrow way to decide this. And it goes back to the discussion about, you know, the majority of the discussions about standing. So, I mean, that the fact that the justices, yes, they pulled out, they picked out some hypotheticals, but that they didn't go directly to the record itself, that only further, at least to me, showed that there's not really an interest in drawing a specific substantive line here when it comes to coercion. But I'm very curious to hear what my co-panelists think on this.
I was struck a little bit about how many of the specific facts were discussed during the oral argument. At an early point, Justice Kagan said, what is your best example of where this has been, has crossed the line? And you had discussions back and forth about particular pages in the record and examples and so on. I think the fact that we were focused in those discussions on one or two specific examples goes to the idea that in this record, you had a lot of smoke. You had a lot of allegations about general contacts and continuing contacts and so on, but not that many when it came to specifics. And when they did, it came up saying, well, 2 months ago, the government sent an email that said this, and then 2 months later, X happened. And as Justice Kagan then said, well, a lot can happen in 2 months, and you don't know what happened that intervened. We don't know whether or not this was a government problem or a platform problem. Did they make the decision or not? And that's the difficulty of locating this kind of cause and effect. And it's one of the reasons why I said in a social media case, it may be really difficult to show both traceability and redressability for particular communications, even though this level of interaction and this level of contact is troubling. As Justice Barrett asked, what if Facebook simply said, these are all difficult questions, why don't we just outsource this? Or what would happen? What would be your answer if we outsourced this to the government? And so there you might not have a traceability issue, but you certainly have a disturbing amount of interaction between government and a private platform.
Yeah, I'll add, You know, I thought the Solicitor General's office did a good job with the record, you know, poking holes in the plaintiff's presentation. For example, the thing that stuck out in my mind was, you know, the Fifth Circuit used this email that asked, you know, had some White House official saying, you know, this Facebook someone, you know, person needs to do something immediately or ASAP, I forget the exact quote. And it was, you know, part of the overall impression that these were demands by the White House. And at oral argument, they're like, that's actually, that what that email was about processing someone's, a White House staffer's approval to be able, so that he could submit a request to take down a false account of the, you know, Biden's granddaughter. So it was something very far afield from, and, you know, I think it probably left the court with the impression, whether it's accurate or not, that, you know, as it said, there are some smoke and mirrors in the plaintiff's brief here that, you know, they, you have these, a huge number of communications from a huge number of officials, but if you track down any particular and try to trace, you know, any particular injury to plaintiffs to any one communication, well, that communication may be one of the ones that was actually not that bad or not that threatening. And the threatening ones were not, you know, traced to the plaintiffs, et cetera. And that it's just, there's a lot of mixing and matching going on. And while you're left with maybe an impression that what's going on is concerning, you're not necessarily sure that they've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's in terms of, you know, really establishing their claims.
Yeah. And in terms of those examples, the district court did virtually nothing to separate the wheat from the chaff. It basically threw in all of the allegations and accepted them as evidence of crossing the line without really analyzing it very skeptically, certainly. The Court of Appeals did a better job of then trying to narrow it down. And if the Supreme Court does reach the merits, I would expect them to narrow it even further in terms of which examples were troubling and which ones were not, and then craft a remedy accordingly, again, if it reaches the merits.
Great. Well, I want to leave a few moments for just the panel to just give some closing thoughts, things that we weren't able to discuss. And I'm sorry to the questions that we weren't able to get to, but I want to just give our panel some moments to just wrap up, give concluding thoughts on this topic, either from the general issue of jawboning and censorship by proxy or what we saw at the court. Well, I guess we'll start with Jess and we'll go in the same order. We'll go Jess, Bob, and then Kristen.
Yeah, I'll just reiterate this, along with the other social media cases that are currently in front of the Supreme Court, are crucial for the continued functionality of the web that we all enjoy and the continued availability of content moderation and third-party content. I'll leave you all with this, that if the court, which I don't see this happening, but if it were to go too far, this would be sort of the first step towards these government actors, be government regulators, lawmakers, being able to enact their censorship agenda against these social media companies. Because remember, in a lot of these cases that have come up with regards to social media content moderation, whether the social media company is a state actor or not is a key question. And if they are, then certain First Amendment considerations, as we've just been discussing in this case so far, there will be certain questions about whether they were allowed to make those content decisions. And in my opinion, that's ultimately what all of these cases are about, is the government doesn't like how these services are moderating content. We saw that very clearly from, you know, or somewhat clearly from some of the evidence in the record. And this case, along with the NetChoice cases, is but a step in being able to get to the ultimate goal of keeping these services from being able to use editorial discretion. So my hope is that the court does keep it narrow. And if anything, makes it very clear that even if there was jawboning found or there was coercion found in this case, that the it was just the government's action alone, and that the injured party is the private publishers that were coerced.
Great. Bob?
I would just say that this term is the most consequential term for First Amendment cases that I've seen since I've been practicing law. And that includes not just the five cases involving the relationship between government and social media, but also more generally, the jawboning phenomenon with two cases argued this week with Murthy versus Missouri and NRA versus Volo. How the court decides those cases is going to determine the shape and extent of First Amendment rights going forward, and particularly in the online world. And as Jess said, there is, starting with the cases, whether or not the states can regulate social media platforms directly, and then in this case, whether or not they can regulate them indirectly, and then two earlier cases that just now decided on whether or not public officials, when they use their personal social media accounts, are going to be considered to be state actors or not. Taken all together, this is a critical term for what the First Amendment is going to look like. And so far, I'm encouraged. The decision in the earlier cases involving social media indicate that the court is really aware of the consequences of what it's deciding. I think it is cognizant of the important stakes in separating government action from state action. And I'm looking forward to what it decides in this case in particular.
And Kristen.
Wow, that was a great summary. The only thing I'll add to that is, you know, the devil's in the details. We've talked, you know, I think it's clear coming out of oral argument that the government can't coerce third parties or, you know, significantly encourage third parties to suppress speech. But what exactly that means, or whether we should have, you know, some more lenient standard to cover persuasion is unclear. And I think, you know, stepping back, we all feel uncomfortable with the idea that the government is in partnership with social media companies to, you know, inform their content moderation policies. But, you know, being concerned with something or kind of feeling having an ick factor isn't a standard that, you know, can be meaningfully applied. And so that is why, you know, Andrew Grossman and I have, you know, developed that policy proposal for transparency as a first start. You know, I think it's often been said that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so in addition to, you know, seeing what the Supreme Court, I'll be interested to see what the Supreme Court, how they handle these cases. But I'd also, you know, just encourage any policymakers listening to really just shine a light on this with transparency.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining me today. I want to thank everyone online for watching and for asking questions. Thank you so much. And we will catch you. We'll inform you as this issue continues to develop. I'm sure you'll see us all writing about this issue. And maybe there'll be follow-up events depending on how these things go. So thank you all for watching and have a good day.